So, hello, my name's Jazza. What's your name, Jimmy?
My name is Jimmy.
Jesus Christ. Well, that's a really good start to the bloody podcast, isn't it?
Well, I wanted to pick up where our previous level of professionalism left off, really.
Like, really low, apparently.
Really, really yeah. low, yes.
So, this is the Right Dishonourable, where we talk about politics and social issues in the UK, but also around the world. We are today going to be talking about the European negotiations that David Cameron, that's the name of the Prime Minister,
isn't it? That is the name of the Prime Minister, yes.
David Cameron has entered into in the last couple of weeks. How embarrassing is he? Oh, David Cameron, you're like my dad. Oh, oops.
We have just been watching Owen Jones videos, so these opinions may be slightly slanted.
We will, like, our final topic is going to be basically us really confused as to why everybody's kind of started getting a YouTube channel, including Owen Jones, and how actually essentially they're all just copying our content.
And halfway through we will be covering the Labour leadership, so we're, you know, we are doing proper topics here as well.
So those stuff. Yeah, so those are the three things that we're going to be talking about in today's podcast. Enjoy it.
Indeed.
Hopefully. So David Cameron has begun the negotiations in order to try and change the
Britain's relationship with the EU.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. As we go into the inevitable referendum, which is going to be by 2017, right?
2017 at latest. They're trying to get it in for 2016 because David Cameron believes a short campaign will benefit the vote to stay in, which is ostensibly what he wants.
There was some awkwardness earlier this week when the reporters who were following him around as he was going from country to country trying to do this renegotiation, in quotation marks, where he did apparently very clearly say that if any of his cabinet ended up wanting to not stay in the EU after his negotiations and would campaign to leave, then they would get sacked. And then he promptly said that, well, I want to be very clear. No, I want to be very clear what I said, and this is what I said. He didn't even say that he'd said anything wrong. It was it was very thick of it.
It is. This is what we're going to see over the next sort of year and a half or whatever, is increasingly fractured relations between the Eurosceptic side of the Tory party and the side represented by David Cameron, who want to remain.
I can't wait. It's going to be horrific, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, part of this interesting dynamic of the slender Tory majority is that it gives the MPs on the right wing of the party a lot of leeway to actually cause mischief. Far more leeway than they had under the previous coalition government, and far more leeway than they would have if we actually had a stronger Tory majority, which is one of the weird things about, you know, parliamentary democracy.
Yeah, I know, it's crap, isn't it? Well, as Owen Jones said in a video that we were just watching, everything in British politics is broken. So
I'd like to clarify, he didn't actually
something
say that.
Along those lines. Something along those lines. Do you think, along the same lines that I do, in that this whole renegotiation is a bit of a farce and it's a bit of a song and dance and it's all a bit of let's play pretend because I just want to stay in, really?
Yeah, well, it's, I think if you read the media coverage, you'd get the impression that it was going reasonably well, but in part I think that's because his demands are so opaque, it's so unclear what he actually is trying to achieve. And the reason for that is if he said, this is what explicitly I want to achieve, it would be far more likely that he would be embarrassed and then he'd come back and have to say, well, I didn't achieve these things that I set out to achieve.
Sozlol.
But we still have to remain in, which would then show the whole strangeness of the process that we're currently going through.
I believe it was the Belgian Prime Minister? Is that the head of state in Belgium? I'm a terrible person. It was the Belgian head of state. Sat down very calmly on British television and said something along the lines of, well, all of these things that you kind of want to try and change, so like the ability for people to claim benefits as soon as they arrive, like more strict checks on people coming in and out of the country. This is all stuff that you can do now. on your own without having to go on this whistle stop tour. Like, I'm sure it's going to be great for David Cameron's air miles, but actually, what is the point in him going and meeting people other than the song and dance of "Look at how hard I am working for the British people"?
Well, maybe this is just my own personal view, but it seems most people think that David Cameron is quite weak on foreign policy in general, because of what happened over the Syria debate, and he just appears to have he doesn't appear to be held in any esteem at all in Europe as
well. There was something that was brought up on Westminster Hour a couple of weeks ago. This week's Westminster Hour, where they were like, he went on a tour to Pakistan and India. He went to India and pissed everybody off by talking about Kashmir, and then went to Pakistan and pissed everybody off by talking about terrorism or something. And it just seems to be going around completely destroying all of the really strong international links that we have, like, traditionally had. And I feel like all of our ambassadors are kind of like wishing, like, oh, please don't let him come to my neck of the woods. We've been working really, really hard.
So, based on, like, your current perception of how British people feel about the EU, do you think we're headed towards Brexit, as it's called, or do you think
Brexit sounds very much like a cereal.
It does.
And I might start marketing that. I do quite like that. But I feel like there's been polling on this, right? There seems to be quite a strong consensus that we're probably going to be staying in.
Well, there was a YouGov poll a couple of weeks back, which was 55% to stay in versus like 45% to leave. But that didn't include the don't knows, and you'd suspect that the don't knows would tend to trend towards staying in because
better the devil you know.
Yeah, exactly. That's the way most polls tend to go. Mm-hmm. However, obviously, we've just had the general election where the pollsters got it quite wrong, and they also got it wrong over the Scottish independence referendum. Admittedly, it turned out that they'd overestimated the closeness in that case, and actually the status quo vote to remain in the UK in the Scottish case was far stronger than they thought. So
what's really interesting is how they're approaching the actual question that's going to be asked, and the whole idea of the wording as well. So if they I read somewhere, I think it was in the Times, that if the wording is would you like the UK to remain part of the European Union, and then people are more likely to say yes than would you like the UK to be part of the European Union.
That's interesting.
So just that change of words of remain and be, like, it had a 3-point swing, which was really, really interesting. And they're probably going to be doing loads of, like, focus groups and polling to try and see which ones are going to give them the most votes to stay in.
Well, I think referendums, the way they're set up, is generally a bit of a con, purely in terms of the way you can manufacture the question to get the result you want.
Chat with Switzerland.
Well, they're also trying to manufacture the way the who can vote. So far the proposal is that 16 and 17 year olds won't be able to vote, even though they could vote in the Scottish independence referendum. And
I mean, this general election is the first time that people have been awarded the vote and then had it taken away. I think it's the first time ever in democracy in general. I think
interesting. But do you have any opinion on, like, the composition of who can vote, or do you have any view on who should be able to vote and who shouldn't?
So the strongest thing, and like, I don't, I used to work for a youth engagement charity. I don't particularly think that the most important thing is having 16 and 17 year olds have the vote, because also they're like a tiny part of the demographic, and they haven't had it traditionally, and the Tories are never going to grant it, so I think people should just stop rabbiting on about it, frankly. I think the most significant thing is that it's only British people in Britain who are going to be able to vote on this. So Brits
I saw
abroad,
the Tories were trying to get the Brits abroad to be able to vote.
It makes it... it's my understanding that they aren't, and I think it's too complicated to do that
logistically.
Yeah,
but actually the Irish people and people from the Commonwealth are also allowed to vote if they're resident in the UK, because it's taken from the general election register, where and that's just the one that's used for all general elections. Local elections also includes other citizens from the EU, not just Irish citizens who are living in Britain. So, but it seems very hard to find a principled cutoff point, because it just looks as though you're trying to rig the election, or rig the referendum, basically.
I mean, they are.
Yeah, I mean, obviously that...
Which is really interesting, both sides are trying to do that. When we had the Scottish referendum, and no was the... stay part of the UK answer.
Yes.
And so that was like really interesting that they got that kind of negotiation. And it does make me worry that David Cameron might not be the best person at kind of making sure that these things go smoothly. Like, he has done incredibly well, and this, there were some people, some commentators saying that this would be his hat trick. So he would have won the Scottish referendum, won the general election, and now he's going to win the EU. So this is going to be like him knocking it out of the park, and then he can go and retire in Cornwall or something. It's probably going to be Ibiza, though, let's be fair. Everyone's in Ibiza these days.
It's a fairly dismal record in many ways, though. Like,
I think many Tories are probably going to think differently about that.
He didn't win an overwhelming mandate as far as the general election goes. The Scottish thing was generally quite badly handled. I mean, maybe historically people will look back and they won't think anything of the Scottish referendum because they know the result. But at the time, it was very much, it seemed as though Scotland could leave, and you know, that was going to happen. And this European thing, I think his general handling of the European issue in general has been not great, I would say.
So we both want to stay in the EU.
Yes,
do you think that we have anything to worry about?
Purely because of the way the Scottish referendum went, and all. If it's, you know, happens in 2017, quite a lot can happen in 2 years. And some people have suggested, which I think is true, is that it might end up being, in some ways, a referendum on. Sort of a vote on how competent the government is. So if in 2 years' time there's a feeling that the Tories aren't really managing sort of the administration of the country very well, I'm not sure how that will actually play out in the vote.
I reckon it's going to be more of a vote against or for UKIP. And more specifically for or against Nigel Farage. And I think that is going to work in the Europhiles' favour because Farage is such a divisive figure.
Which
is actually, in the grand scheme of things, for Europe and for the UK staying in Europe, Nigel Farage staying on as leader is probably the best thing that could have possibly happened, because if they had somebody rational, then like somebody might have actually made some arguments that swayed people's opinions. You can check out all of the kind of lovely things that we're posting on the blog as well on rightdishonourable.com.
Indeed, yes.
Excellent, yeah. Good, well done, Jazza.
Yes.
And also, for up-to-date stuff on what we're talking about, specifically about the EU, why not follow our Twitter? That would be good, wouldn't it?
That would be good. Natalie Bennett has just started following us on Twitter.
Natalie Bennett
should too.
Has just started following us on Twitter. And if that isn't an incentive enough for you to do the same... then
nothing will be.
I mean, so. Frankly, nothing will be. Let's wait until Davcam joins her.
Yeah, I'm not sure Davcam does the Twitter. You know, he doesn't. I'm not sure he handles that himself.
Shh. Are you going to introduce this one?
Do you want me to?
Yeah.
How cloud?
Because you need to learn how to introduce topics. So go.
So, in the Labour leadership election following Ed Miliband's hasty retirement after after the party's destruction at the polls, there are now, I think, 4 or 5 candidates it's been whittled down to. I'm going to have to remember this. Liz Kendall, Andy Burnham and Yvette Cooper are the three front runners.
The only ones that really...
Going to end up on the ballot sheet. Mary Cray just dropped out.
Yeah, bless her.
And the only other person who is in the running but probably won't make the ballot because he won't have the support of enough MPs is Jeremy Corbyn.
Everyone's really excited about him, but he should just join the Greens, really, shouldn't he?
I mean, he does tend to hang out at a lot of these sort of fringe left events run by the People's Assembly and the Socialist Workers' Party, which I think does suggest a certain amount about the way his politics are going, We do have a profile of him on the website, actually, at rightdishonourable.com.
That was an amazing plug, and I'm really proud of you.
We're probably not going to talk about him because he's not, as Jazza said, he's not going to make it onto the ballot sheet. Even if he does, he won't actually win. The main candidates that we need to focus on are, again, Andy Burnham, who is centre-left, Liz Kendall, who's centre-right of the party, and Yvette Cooper, who's kind of the dead centre between those two candidates.
I would argue that that isn't a helpful way to define them. So the way that I'm kind of defining them is Liz Kendall is kind of very much like, I agree with David Cameron.
Mm.
Yvette Cooper is the, God, please tell me what I should be saying. What do you believe? Because I believe that too. And Andy Burnham is, I should just be anointed right here, right now. So that's how I'm defining them, rather than spectrum of left and right.
I think there's using different terms to describe roughly the same thing going on there.
Oh, but... and also Andy Burnham's dreamy.
Is he?
Yeah, he's got lovely eyebrows. Good eyebrows.
Does
game.
The Northern accent thing, do it for you?
No, he needs to be gagged. but he's well fit. Like, I wouldn't complain.
I mean, but aside from the fitness of the candidates, is there anyone that you think would actually be good for the party? In terms of future electoral prospects, beyond
I was originally going to write something about this for the website, but then,
life got in the way.
I'm Jazza, and if I followed through with things, then it just wouldn't be the same. And it was very much... So I think that Andy Burnham and Yvette Cooper are going to split their vote. So I think that the runoff is probably actually going to end up being between Andy and Liz.
Interesting.
I know, I'm very interesting. And I have very little to base this on other than a hunch. But I believe that if either of them were to become the party leader, we're going to see a huge rift happen between Labour in Scotland and Labour in the rest of the UK.
I mean, is there still a Labour Party in Scotland, arguably?
They have one MP.
One MP and presumably a handful of councillors and that sort of thing.
Yeah, that, I mean, what more do you need, right? The Raving Loony Party is a legitimate party, and so if the Scottish Labour can at least get more votes than them, then that's what's important, right?
I mean, do you think for the future, because of how well the SNP have done, that Labour don't really have a future in Scotland?
I think that they do, but it's going to involve them having a completely separate narrative to the rest of the United Kingdom. So Andy Burnham has specifically said, I think that there should be a Labour Party for Scotland, and I think that it should be run separately. And Liz Kendall is so bloody right wing that she, like, everybody north of the border is going to bloody hate her, and isn't going to be able to empathise with the kind of more left leaning Scots. But that the thing is, if Labour want to get back some of the votes that they lost quite significantly in the election, I think the only sensible option is to tack right. Mm. And is to be more Blairite, because there's all of this stuff about oh my god, Tony Blair needs to back off because nobody likes him. He won 3 elections, like, he did okay.
Mm.
He's the most successful Labour politician ever.
But there's this whole argument within every party is that for the grassroots and the supporters of a party, you generally want more ideological purity than you can actually get if you want to be an electable party.
We had ideological purity with Ed Miliband, and that went spiffingly, didn't it?
So do you buy the thesis that Labour lost the election because they were too left-wing then?
I think that was part of the reason. People like my parents would very happily, who are from the deepest, darkest depths of Essex, would very happily vote for somebody like Liz Kendall, but someone like Ed Miliband, who is seen as, like, a lefty loony, quite frankly, mainly by the publications that they read. But something that's really interesting is when you look at all of the endorsements that the newspapers did for the general election.
So broadly speaking, most people said Tory or coalition, basically.
It was like 70 to 80% of the publications across the UK were like pro-Tory.
Mm.
And the only way that you're going to... And I think that newspapers, though a dying art, are still the people that kind of drive the national narrative and drive what people's kind of opinions are of those that they will eventually end up voting for. And Liz Kendall is the only one, I believe, who is going to be able to win those... the media elite over, to be completely honest.
Is it interesting that Labour will have its first female leader, do you think? Does that play at all?
I really like that it doesn't matter. So we have the three frontrunners, Yvette, Liz and Andy, and I will call them by their first names because we're best mates.
Yeah. Well, they're down with the people, aren't they?
Yeah, so. But the fact that two of the three frontrunners are women, and for... a very long time, three out of the five frontrunners were women.
Mm.
Like, this is a female-dominated party at the top, at the very top at the moment. Harriet Harman is standing in as the deputy, as the leader at the moment. We will probably have a... is Caroline Flint a good bet for Labour deputy leader? That would be interesting if we had two women at the top.
I thought it was Tom Watson who was... and Stella Creasy, who were vying for deputy leadership.
I thought that, well, I'm clearly reading different things to you.
Obviously, yes.
But I...
They're both running, whether or not they're... Mm-hmm. I mean, I think Tom Watson is a relatively fair bet, but I don't know if he's the top
one. He's quite popular.
I know Andy Burnham is still, despite all the stuff we just said about women, is still the most likely future Labour leader.
He is. But bringing it back to the women, I think that it's really cool that it genuinely doesn't seem to have mattered.
It hasn't really played at all, no. I mean, that was another interesting thing about Chakramuna dropping out, is that he potentially could have been the first black leader of the major two British parties.
What was really awkward was people are like, oh, we need... after the hustings that have been happening for the Labour Party leadership, people have been like, we need a Barack Obama moment. And Barack Obama was being spoken in the same breath as Chakramuna quite a lot. And it's like... just because they're black does not mean they are the same
person. They have slightly foreign-sounding names as well, so they must be exactly the same. You know, that's how it works.
Yeah, exactly.
But, I mean, aside from the fact that it is a female-dominated leadership election, they're all sort of vulnerable to this complaint about that Labour's been essentially taken over by the middle classes. And you could argue that Labour has always been run predominantly by the middle classes, but... As far as I'm aware, like Liz Kendall and Yvette Cooper are certainly very middle class. Harriet Harman is actually the niece of a lord or an earl or something. So it is
shock horror.
You know, it's a very is that a problem for Labour? Do you think does that really matter, that side of things?
The working classes are always going to vote Labour. The working classes in England are always going to.
But they don't now. Some of them vote UKIP, and some of them vote Tory as well.
Yeah, but. Labour hasn't lost any seats to UKIP, right? I think that in our current election system, I don't think that UKIP is a big enough of a force for them. Like there's going to be seats where they have to have a battleground, but I don't think UKIP is quite there yet, and especially under first past the post. But the working classes are not the people that need to be won over, I don't think. It's Middle England, and it's actually, I think... people who are just like Yvette Cooper and Liz Kendall. The thing is, though, I'm not sure that middle class women who are like perhaps professional or perhaps are stay at home mums or like semi professional, I don't think that those women, well, maybe they aren't going to vote for somebody who is like them.
Well, I read one analysis where somebody said that there, despite the fact you said that it doesn't necessarily matter if a woman is the leader, that there is still a penalty for, in terms of voting, for standing leaders standing MPs in general elections or standing candidates for being an MP in general elections. There's still a tendency among, oddly enough, women not to vote for women when they run for office in certain places.
Self-hate. In it.
Well, I've no idea why it might be in terms of like psychology, but I've heard that that is true.
It's very interesting. Let's wrap this up. And so, who is your favourite to win? Who would you like to see lead the Labour Party, and who do you think is going to win? Because I think we actually...
I feel we should, somewhat in the interest of responsible disclosure, we are actually both members of the Liberal Democrats.
Yes.
And I... I do prefer probably a Blairite Labour to the certainly the sort of Cameronian Tories or whatever. But
Cameronian. I think they're called Cameroons.
Cameroons.
Which I really actually quite enjoy because I've never said that out loud before.
But I mean, I almost don't care, really. Yeah. It doesn't actually bother me which way Labour tack. Because I don't.
So who do you think will win? Because I have loads of opinions.
I still think Burnham will win.
Uh-huh.
But that just seems to be the way the people, like political reporters, have tested the water and, you know, spoken to people, and that seems to be the way that things are going. And I think even though the unions are actually not allowed to vote as a bloc anymore, they will register lots of affiliated members. And there will be a big turn-up from them, and I think that they will mostly go for Burnham.
So I agree that I think Burnham will win, but I think that's going to be to Labour's detriment, because he's essentially, I think, going to be a better-looking Ed Miliband.
With a northern accent, and with,
like, legitimate working-class roots.
So are we not buying the argument which is being made on the Labour left at the moment, that the Ed Miliband problem was largely a stylistic one as opposed to a substance one?
I don't know. But I know a lot of people who didn't necessarily have a problem with Ed Miliband, but had a huge problem with somebody like Ed Balls. Mm. And a problem with giving the nation's purse over to somebody who had that track record, working alongside Gordon Brown during the crash. I think that was probably one of the strongest things for, like, the middle-class, self-employed, founded-their-own-business person. And for that reason, and for there to be a strong and viable Labour in England with a separate Scottish Labour Party, which I think is important, somebody like Liz Kendall would probably be my shoo-in and my favourite.
But I mean, we could argue to a certain extent that what's bad for the Labour Party might be beneficial for the Lib Dems.
I think we've got a really long way to go before we start talking about that. Although, also, we should talk about Yvette Cooper. I think it would be really cool to have the UK's second largest party run by an android. I think that's...
that's a good thing for android rights and their future.
In the last 2 weeks or so, we've seen Owen Jones, the Guardian darling, from the north, wade into YouTube and become one of our very own, become a YouTuber. He has joined Russell Brand as yet another
YouTuber,
like, left-wing traditional media folk using internet video to get their point across. And we also saw during the general election quite a lot of specifically the Labour Party and some awkward things from Nick Clegg as well, of them kind of using online video in a really kind of
naff way.
That's how I would say. What do you think, first of all, of Owen Jones coming onto YouTube? Why do you think he's done this? Why is everybody coming up and stealing my USP?
I didn't realise you had a USP.
My USP is being the only person who talks about social commentary in the UK YouTube sphere, and people are encroaching on that territory, and I don't like
it's
it.
It's good, you'll be able to fight over the 2,000 people who, you know, watch politics on YouTube.
Yeah. Owen Jones has been doing okay.
He has, yeah.
Still got more subscribers than me, though.
To answer your question, though, I see it as part of the Guardian sort of overall strategy to make more of the web. Papers, it's been by far the most forthcoming in adapting to the web and doing live blogs and engaging in social media. So I just see it as that, really. I'm not sure how much it's driven by him, but they are nicely put together videos.
They are really well put together, and I wish I had his editor. Do you think that any of the stuff that went live during the election campaign was useful at all? So we saw Ed Miliband sit down with YouTube's very own Nikki and Sammy, and him being asked to do a banter pose and saying no. And also seeing Brand publicly endorse Ed Miliband and his campaign as well.
The banter pose thing, I think, is sort of very emblematic of how the old media and how politicians feel about social media is that it's a format that's dominated by young people. And
we will post a, if you haven't seen the video of Nikki and Sammy talking to Ed Miliband, we'll post that on our Twitter account, which is twitter.com/rightdishonor.
Yes, it is. But yeah, it's just this kind of awkwardness and this slight sense that your dad is turning up to the party and is just, you know, not, it doesn't really belong there or fit in. I mean, it was certainly...
Do you think that those interactions that Ed Miliband had helped his campaign at all? Clearly
not enough.
Not enough. But having the endorsement from Russell Brand, engaging with young people online, because the Conservative Party, from my perspective anyway, were almost actively trying to get everybody off of social media and trying to not have people actively engage with the online space, whereas Labour were pushing that really, really hard.
I think the trouble from the right wing's point of view is that when they try and do these kind of online campaigns, so a very common thing is sort of, in any online campaign, is to create a hashtag and get people to sort of tweet something positive about what it is you're doing. And
you've just explained social media, though.
I have, yeah.
Very good.
You've obviously been doing it wrong all this time. But there's this infamous campaign from a couple of years back, which was hashtag your NYPD is in New York Police Department. And it was set up by, I realise New York Police Department isn't necessarily right wing, but what they set this campaign up hoping that people would send positive things about the New York Police Department. And obviously what happened is people sent pictures of police violence and police brutality. And I feel that that is sort of the problem that right-wing parties like the Conservatives and UKIP have when they go on social media, is that they're just so vulnerable to being mocked, basically.
But there are so many of the really big political commentators in the UK YouTube space, they're all right-wing. And Owen Jones and Russell Brand are the kind of like exception to the rule, and they get more media attention because they are...
did you say the YouTube?
Yeah, so there's people like Pat Condell, yes, who is like an anti-Islamic...
I feel
person who manages to film like 10 to 15 minute videos very eloquently without cuts.
I believe he used to be a stand up comic or something like that. He has some sort of background in
fantastic.
Yeah.
But he's like a very vocal and very popular YouTuber.
Well, there's people like, I don't know if you'd fit, how you'd fit these into a traditional left right spectrum, people like The Amazing Atheist and I guess also Milo Yiannopoulos does certain things on YouTube. He has a YouTube channel, and he occasionally does podcasts and stuff.
Yeah.
So there are, you know, there's people across the spectrum. But I think, I mean, in the case of the Russell Brand thing, I think it was just part of the demonisation of Ed Miliband that was sort of picked up upon. And because, you know, it was part of this whole thing of Ed Miliband's weird and you can't trust him and he's going to fuck up the economy. And... you know,
we'll never know. What a shame.
Yes, indeed. I don't know. It's...
Do you think that this particularly adds anything to the general discussion around politics that we have? Or are we just going to end up going into yet another little box where everybody has their echo chamber and agrees with everything? Because that's one of the huge issues that I have with Russell Brand stuff, is that he surrounds himself and the guests that he has on are all people that he agrees with, and are all people that are very like strongly in favour of his message of like civic action and anti-right wing, anti-austerity, all those kind of narratives. And there's never really a discussion and an actual debate that happens. It ends up being either you agree with me or, oh, you disagree with me, but you're a troll because you said that I look ugly, etc., etc., etc.
Well, I don't know if you've seen the research around how search algorithms can, and sorry, your search history on Google can shape what search results you get. Mm-hmm. So if, and Facebook is also another example of this, and Twitter as well, because people effectively curate their own news feeds, and therefore they can decide whose content they want to see and whose content they don't. And the way Google search algorithms work is that if they notice you go to particular websites with, you know, certain opinions, they will be more likely to show you those websites when you search for news. There's various debates about how exactly that works, but that does seem to be broadly true.
So do you think that this is just going to be more... that this isn't going to particularly add to any kind of debate at all?
Well,
it's not going to improve our democracy.
If you compare it to the way it used to be, where people used to basically read one newspaper unless they were in the media, where they'd read several. But nowadays you can read stuff from The Guardian and The Telegraph,
BuzzFeed,
if that's something you want to do. FT,
Ten
BBC.
Things You Didn't Know About David Cameron. Number 7 made me lose my mind.
Indeed, yes. Mm-hmm. But actually, I think it's because it's more fragmented and because people can pick up different things from different places. I think actually the online media world is better in terms of exposing people to other people's ideas. Apart from the house, the cost of reading an opinion piece from The Telegraph, if you're a left winger now, is far lower than it used to be.
Mm-hmm. So, but then it ends up being that in order for people to want to engage with these kinds of things, they have to be Katie Hopkins and have to be incredibly, contentious, in order for them to garner the kind of attention that you would want people who have differing opinions to you. And Russell Brand is another example of this. He is so anarchic and left wing that it means that he attracts people who agree and disagree with him. But if you're quite a sensible person having quite a sensible conversation, then you're not going to really be picked up anywhere.
This maybe doesn't bode well for the future of this podcast.
I mean, I would never describe us as sensible.
That's true.
And also, where do we fit in with this? Because we're digital natives, right?
Sure.
We don't have a background in the traditional media. We're self-made men. Kinda. I bought this microphone with my own money. Where do
you're probably in a better position to say than I am, because you've been doing this for so much longer.
You ask me the question.
Do you feel that the new media is going to overtake the old media as the primary way that people consume their news?
I don't think it ever will.
Okay.
Because apart from exceptions like Vice. And BuzzFeed, investigative and intelligent and long-form journalism just doesn't really exist. So you see the stuff that people are talking about Owen Jones and Russell Brand. I think we should do a drinking game where every time we say Owen or Russell, take a shot. Ding, ding, ding. I feel like they are kind of using this as a supplement to their
existing careers.
Yeah,
sure.
None of them are making money off of this. This is just an additional thing. And great, Owen Jones is doing video for The Guardian now that's actually on YouTube rather than on The Guardian Player. Woo, excellent. But in order for there to be really in-depth analysis and people who are professionals, I don't think that you're going to be able to get rid of traditional broadcasters or broadsheet newspapers in that sense.
Well, I still think that the best way of creating good investigative journalism is in long-form writing or long-form documentaries, which is exactly the opposite type of content that social media thrives on.
Apart from Vice News, though, right? So Vice News, the YouTube channel, has over 1 million subscribers, does amazingly well, and has long-form documentaries that go up.
I feel Vice is very much the exception, though, in terms of how the new media economy is working.
Yeah. But it proves that exists. And then there's also the Young Turks in the US who do a couple of hours of a TV show every evening and live stream that on YouTube.
There's definitely space at the moment for a lot of very interesting and varied different types of content, which there probably wasn't before the internet became so central to the way the media functions.
So, going forward, do you think we're going to see more Owen Joneses talking awkwardly into cameras and displaying
their hats? As older columnists retire and the new generation... Because genuinely, I think there is a certain... I can't imagine, say... Peter Hitchens setting up a YouTube channel. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's my impression of Peter Hitchens, but the older type of columnists I don't think will ever engage in the way Owen Jones is engaging, but newer ones, I think it will be expected. I mean, if when you apply for a job in journalism these days, it is expected you have some familiarity with social media.
So we are going to end that there, but we really want to continue this discussion with you guys on the internet, this new newfangled technology that's changing the media. It's very exciting. You can chat to us on The Right Dishonor on Twitter. Go to our website, read some of the lovely stuff that anybody apart from me is writing, because
if Jazza does write something, then definitely be nice about it.
It will break the internet. It happens so rarely. I mean, it has yet to happen. and you can follow us as well. I'm at JazzaJohn on Twitter, and what's your handle?
I'm at JDE Nichols.
That, which is rolls off the tongue. He did very well in choosing his own online brand.
I did, yes.
But yes, thank you very much for listening to The Right Dishonourable. We will possibly be back next week.
We will.
Don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes. Because this should be on iTunes if we figure out how to do that. All tentative.
If this isn't on iTunes and you're listening to this on YouTube, then send Jazz an abusive email. Just to
please do. Yes, I have been Jazza.
I've been Jimmy.
And this has been The Right Dishonourable. Goodbye. Those are the three things that we're going to be talking about in today's podcast. Enjoy it.
Indeed.
Hopefully. Doodle doo 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 doodle doo doo doodle doo doo doo.
I would love if you actually just made that the jingle. That would be good.
I mean, I'll stick it at the end as an extra. It'll be like an Easter egg.
That awkward 30 seconds, and then you just going doodle doo doo.
Yeah, that would be beautiful.